Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is excerpts from a panel held at the No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference in Washington, D.C. on July 6, 2024. The conference was a counter-summit to NATO's 75th anniversary summit held the following week. We start with David Swanson of World Beyond War.
The NATO of popular imagination is an assembly of representatives of democratic nations who commit to making the world more peaceful, including by militarily defending each other if one of them is attacked. There could hardly exist a more grave collection of lies. NATO is, in fact, an institution devoted primarily to the increased sale of weaponry to governments of every type. Neither its members nor its often openly dictatorial partners acting at the bidding of any populace, and devoted secondarily to doing the will of one government, that based right here in Washington, D.C., where Joe says he is running the world, and which is represented by over 900 military bases outside its borders. NATO's wars have never involved defending one of its members from a foreign invasion. Only once ever has NATO even claimed to be calling its members to collective defense, and that was for the idiotic, mass murderous, environmentally catastrophic, counterproductive on its own terms, 20-year war on the distant, impoverished nation of Afghanistan, waged principally for U.S. political reasons following terrorist attacks, even though terrorist attacks have not been used as a justification for NATO wars when they have happened in any other NATO member country, and waged by NATO only following the individual U.S. attack on Afghanistan that overthrew a government made up of people who, with a very few tweaks, would fit in very well a couple of blocks from right here on the U.S. Supreme Court. Every other NATO war has lacked even the ridiculous pretense of defensiveness, and often even any agreement among NATO members, so that one could debate what has or hasn't been a NATO war, were one to ignore the fact that the staff and the infrastructure of NATO have been used to launch or continue or escalate the wars on Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine, and Gaza. Not a single one of these has been legal, neither before nor during NATO involvement. NATO has no power to legalize anything. Even the NATO of popular imagination would be a criminal enterprise, even during a war of the popular imagination involving an angelically innocent nation invaded out of the blue by subhuman monsters. There is nothing in the UN Charter about Good Samaritan mass murder machines joining in an authorized war. There is much in actual human history to suggest the value of negotiation, diplomacy, demilitarization, unarmed civilian defense, and an actual law-based order, and to suggest that these alternatives are damaged by heavy investment in institutions dedicated to the structures and the cultures that drive weapons sales. In Bosnia and Serbia, NATO first went to war and did so against a nation that had not attacked or even threatened any NATO member, and despite some NATO members wanting to work for peace. The U.S. went to war without approval from the UN or even from the U.S. Congress, but with the new law unto itself, NATO proclamation of humanitarian war. In the U.S. government, those wanting more wars had discovered that they could justify them by bringing vassal states along. In Congress, it was discovered that particular horrors in wars wouldn't need to be investigated if they could be labeled as NATO's. And NATO doesn't have any government to investigate it because it's not a nation. It just plays one on TV, sending its unelected leader around the world to do joint press conferences with prime ministers and presidents. The biggest discovery, however, was that there needed to be no end of Cold War peace dividend. In fact, there needed to be no end to the Cold War, War, it was discovered, could be an endless humanitarian public service, fending off an array of ineliminable threats, from terrorists to pirates to China to Russia to various governments buying their weapons from the wrong places. Horrible governments, to be sure, but no more horrible than many of those buying their weapons from the right places. And of course, wars kill a lot more than governments, and generally do not kill governments at all. NATO's grandest accomplishment thus far is the destruction of Afghanistan, the deforestation and poisoning of the land, the killing of hundreds of thousands of people, the making homeless of millions, the diversion of trillions of badly needed dollars into massive devastation, and the defeat of the vast majority of the world's militaries by an impoverished and divided people reduced to stealing the invaders' equipment and selling the invaders' drugs to finance a successful resistance. Not to mention the propaganda accomplishment, which takes no notice of any of this reality, namely the merging of the criminal and nonsensical humanitarian war with the criminal and nonsensical war of revenge. In U.S. culture, a war as horrific as that on Afghanistan can be transformed into a glowing model of goodness and wonder simply by launching another war that is even worse. Once the war on Iraq was despised enough to require people like Barack Obama to pretend to oppose it, the war on Afghanistan had to be a good war. In the manner in which World War II had become the ultimate good war during the war on Vietnam. And yet, quite shamelessly and openly, what makes Afghanistan a good war is in part that it was a war of revenge, a justification present in no law or treaty whatsoever, but absent from almost no Hollywood movie in my lifetime. Somebody had stepped out of line. Somebody had disrespected NATO and that little sliver of the world's population called the international community, and therefore the people who lived in a place those criminals had spent some time in needed to pay with their lives. And because the last moments of the war were as violent as the previous 20 years, the problem is now understood as not what the war did, but how it was ended, or even that it was ended. Of course, Tony Blair, humanitarian Middle East expert, had told George W. Bush, famous portrait painter and master's class instructor, that it would be okay to attack Iraq if they attacked Afghanistan first, because revenge. And attack Iraq they did without formal NATO involvement, which is part of what has left NATO with a reputation of being more law-abiding than your average Congress member. But NATO militaries were bullied into helping. And eventually Iraq became the site of a NATO training mission that was a little hard to distinguish from a US-led occupation with the same US generals in charge of both things, and which persists in a newer version to this day, despite Iraqi demand for Nexit, if you will allow that word. In 2003, there were moves in a Belgian court to prosecute General Tommy Franks, thank you to our Belgians in the room, the commander of the US troops in Iraq, for using cluster bombs in civilian areas. U.S. Secretary of so-called Defense Donald Rumsfeld dealt with that problem at a NATO meeting by warning Belgium that the U.S. would not fund NATO's headquarters in Belgium and would not take part in meetings in Belgium, leaving the impression that NATO headquarters would be moved elsewhere. Instead of shouting, "Good riddance and take your illegal nuclear weapons with you," Belgium fell in line, a tool in the tools-based order. The prosecution quickly disappeared while the war on Iraq rolled on unchanged. In 2011, NATO decided to attack Libya. It lied about threats to Libyans and pretended that a UN resolution on protecting Libyans was an authorization for a war, the bombing of the country, the overthrow of the government, leaving chaos and mountains of weapons spreading across the region for years afterwards, not to mention open-air slave markets. The excuse for the war was even called genocide prevention, This was back, remember, before genocide facilitation became the respectable order of the day on Capitol Hill. To its credit, the U.S. Congress, like the UN, like all laws and treaties, like much of the world, opposed the war. To its shame, it did nothing about it. Once a president does something, especially if it's under the banner of NATO, that means it is not illegal. This was effectively true when Richard Nixon said it, and has been even more true right up until the Supreme Court recently said it. You're going to hear from other speakers here about Ukraine and Gaza and the South China Sea. I want to comment briefly on Ukraine because it is the lie that half the U.S. public believes, because it is the foundation of support for NATO, because in one of the weirdest developments that I can recall, it is in the U.S. and in Europe, right-wing racist militarist fascistic figures who are most open to ending this particular war, albeit in order to focus on other wars. The facts suggest that Ukraine is harmed, not helped, by endless weapons shipments. In December of 2021, Russia proposed an agreement focused on Ukraine not joining NATO, and the U.S. rejected it. The criminal, murderous, inexcusable Russian invasion that followed was motivated, according to the Secretary General of NATO, by NATO's refusal to exclude Ukraine. Just after the invasion, in March 2022, after negotiations mediated by Turkey, it appeared that Russia was ready to withdraw from Ukraine if Ukraine would commit to not joining NATO, and that Ukraine was prepared to agree. We'll never know for sure, but we do know that well-sourced news reports show that the US and the UK told Ukraine to refuse the deal and keep the war going. Even now, after all the slaughter and destruction, the U.S. could allow Ukraine to sit down and negotiate with Russia, could indicate that there's a limit to the supply of free weapons. But the Secretary General of NATO has publicly told the U.S. government to allow Ukraine to use U.S. weapons to attack inside Russia, and the U.S. government has agreed. The plan is escalation, not negotiation. NATO bragged last year that it had trained 800 Ukrainians to be as corruption-free as a U.S. politician. And yet, after dumping unlimited, unaccountable weapons and dollars into the place and insisting on war for years, who knows how this came about, but Ukraine is still corrupt. And NATO says it's too corrupt for NATO. Or rather, NATO still can't corrupt all of its members into inviting Ukraine to join it. But it can move many of them to make bilateral commitments to Ukraine, it can militarize the whole region, and it can prepare the West culturally for World War III. After all, how much preparation do you need to say goodbye to everything? When top scientists and observers keep warning that we are closer than ever to a nuclear war, to a threat to all life on Earth, whatever one does to increase that risk makes one an opponent of humanity. While Ukrainians and Russians are exactly as valuable as everyone else, most everyone else gets forgotten and treated as worthless if we consider a nuclear risking war in only local terms. What happens in Ukraine does not stay in Ukraine. NATO calls itself a nuclear alliance. It maintains a nuclear planning group for all of its members, those with and without nuclear weapons, to discuss the launching of the sort of war that puts all life on Earth at risk, and to coordinate rehearsals or war games practicing for the use of nuclear weapons in Europe, where the U.S. uses NATO as cover to illegally proliferate nuclear weapons to six nations, and Russia now follows suit. We are in trouble and need a radical reversal, not because NATO is a good idea that's gone bad, not because NATO could be a good idea if some other countries did it, not because NATO must be a good idea because we imagine, rightly or wrongly, that certain odious individuals oppose it for their own quirky reasons, but because the enemy of life on Earth is the institutionalization of war, the establishment, normalization, and acceptance of mass murder as a public service. On this 4th of July weekend, let us recall that the United States was born out of war, a war for power, empire, and slavery, as well as for limited freedoms for a limited number of people. There have been few moments of peace for the U.S. military ever since. Nations that lend their names and their respectability to a war addict are not its friends. The friendly thing to do would be to cut it off and take an independent stand for peace.
Next up is Alain Roy, Vice President of the International Peace Bureau.
In France, NATO has never been very popular because the USA, which dominates this military alliance, respects neither the diplomatic nor the military autonomy of the member states. That's why in 1966, the president of the French Republic, Charles de Gaulle, decided to withdraw France from the integrated military structures and to close the US military bases in France. De Gaulle did not dispute the existence of the Atlantic Alliance, and he had always been a loyal ally of the United States in times of East-West crisis. But de Gaulle contested the determining weight of the USA in the integrated military command at the service of the American policy of hegemony. De Gaulle was opposed to bloc politics. He refused to alienate member states to the will and to the interests of the United States. After De Gaulle, other French presidents have also opposed NATO's orientations. President François Mitterrand contested the American conception of global security assured by NATO. And Mitterrand questioned NATO's role after the end of the USSR. President Jacques Chirac criticized NATO's evolution toward a broader alliance engaged in military intervention, a NATO that presents itself in Kosovo or in Afghanistan as a kind of armored arm of the UN, which France totally rejects. Logically, in 2003, Jacques Chirac announced that he would veto any UN resolution authorizing war against Iraq, and he did it. The fears and the criticism expressed by French presidents in their days would be even more justified today. Global NATO is no longer a defensive military alliance, but an offensive alliance at the service of the Western powers, and first and foremost at the service of the United States. Unfortunately, since President Sarkozy, successive presidents have broken with the tradition of the independence of French policy. France has re-entered NATO's integrated command. France is systematically aligning itself with US policy. And now the actual president, Emmanuel Macron, is calling those who won't help Ukraine fight to military victory, he calls them cowards. Before Macron became one of the most aggressive leaders in the Western camp, French diplomacy had played a positive role in recognizing that Russian demands for security guarantees had to be taken into account. It was the case for the Minsk agreements in 2014 and 2015, the Minsk agreements for which France was a guarantor, along with Germany. The positive role was again the case in February 24, when Macron maintained, at the beginning, contact with Putin, and he spoke from security guarantees for Russia. But now we heard something else. He wants support Ukraine till the victory, he said. And he forgets that the war in Ukraine didn't start in February 2022 with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Putin's illegal and criminal invasion is the culmination of a conflict that began with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Like Mikhail Gorbachev, we might have believed that a new era was possible. A new era was about to begin, an era of collective security and cooperation. But this was not the case. The West proclaimed its victory. The West wanted to extend its economic system to the whole planet. And to this aim, it maintained, it enlarged, and it strengthened NATO. NATO is the USA real armed arm on the whole planet. This is the context in which the war in Ukraine must be analyzed. Russia feels threatened by Western expansion, and Russia sets a red line. Ukraine must not join NATO. To reach that, Putin, the nationalist Putin, believed only in force, in invasion, in military means, and he deliberately violated the United Nations Charter. But in the end, this war will benefit NATO. NATO welcomed Finland and Sweden as new members on Russia's borders. NATO increased its hold on the European Union. And today, NATO is fanning the flames of conflict and has no interest in negotiating an end to the war in Ukraine. You said it, David, and it's true. In NATO's bloc logic, confrontation and expansion are more important than peace efforts. NATO means never-ending militarization of the international relations. Yet we know that the foundations for an agreement to put an end to the war in Ukraine exist. They were already laid down in the Minsk agreements, and they were still being formulated during the negotiations in Turkey in March 2022, as David reminded us. These bases for an agreement include the neutrality of Ukraine, the self-determination for the populations of Crimea and Donbas, and security agreements guaranteed by the international community. NATO countries have pushed Ukraine to reject such agreements and interrupt all negotiations. For NATO, the only valid notion of security is security by force and military supremacy. That's why NATO cannot be a force for peace, neither in Ukraine nor anywhere else in the world. The war in Ukraine has become one of the NATO's confrontation with those designated as systemic rivals in the NATO 2030 strategic documents. China and Russia are designated as systemic rivals. These orientations cannot bring greater security to the world. On the contrary, they make NATO a factor of aggravated insecurity. We must oppose this global NATO with all our energy, which is why we all counter summits and demonstrations every year at the times of NATO summits. But we must also develop alternatives to NATO, and we have to reprioritize the notion of common security. France is currently going through a very dangerous period because we have the risk of the extreme right coming to power. But we are not resigning ourselves, and we appreciate that the ideas of the pacifists inspire the force of progress. It will be too short to have a victory for this force, I think, but we can impeach the extreme right to come to the power, I think. And we are happy that the French progressive forces are reviving the tradition of independent diplomacy and the tradition of peace politics for France. It means breaking free from the NATO straitjacket. France could become again a force for peace and disarmament in the service of social and climate justice. That's why I hope, and we can all hope, for our country in the coming days. We know there is no justice without peace, no peace without justice. So we say no to NATO, no to the war. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Mo'taz Salim, a Palestinian-American from Gaza, advocating for an end to the genocide and a free Palestine.
I'll start off with Palestine, because we usually refer to Gaza and what's happening in Gaza as the tip of the spear of imperialism, which is essentially, as far as I'm concerned, NATO's primary role as an organization is to further Western European, US-dominated imperialism and to continue to influence other regions in the world, typically through force, through military supremacy. And so just to start off, I always like to center, especially when I speak, back to Palestine, and then we can talk more about the Middle East as a whole. So Palestine, currently over 40,000 individuals have been murdered by the Israeli state and government and the Israeli occupation forces. We've seen, especially in the last couple of months, more and more and more egregious war crimes being uncovered. War crimes that, by the way, Palestinians have been reporting since October and before October, but now we're seeing them being uncovered by all these Western outlets as well, which finally decided to conduct an investigation or two while they also justify the genocide. And just to highlight some of those, there have been, I don't know the exact number of mass graves uncovered in Palestine, but I know of at least 5 or 6 mass graves of over 100, 150 people uncovered underneath hospitals, such as the El Shifa Hospital. And there's also been many reports about the, I'm going to call them what they are, they're essentially concentration camps and torture camps that have been specifically created to subjugate the Palestinian population, humiliate them, torture them, and ultimately either murder them or drive them out. And a very clear example of that is this Sde' Taidman camp, which has had a lot of reporting about it because CNN, again, one time decided to do an investigation like 3 months, 4 months after many Palestinian journalists and journalists in the region were trying to get the world to pay attention to it. So that's kind of the price that's been paid so far. But what I will also say is that Palestine has also shown us how the Zionist state, Israel, always tries to present itself, and it's done so successfully for most of its history, as impenetrable, almost like an invincible state that there is no way to kind of counter it, there's no way to resist it, there's no way to fight it. And what Palestine and Gaza specifically has shown us is that this is an outright lie, a very well-constructed lie to try and even discourage people from even considering the fact that the Israeli state can be resisted. There can be an end to the genocide and the depraved war crimes that it has committed for 9 months now and for 75 plus years before that. So NATO, almost 2 years ago, launched what's called the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, which essentially was an effort to bolster its ties with some of the Gulf states, such as the UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait. It's essentially an initiative to bolster military relations, because at the end of the day, that's NATO's primary way of conducting, quote unquote, diplomacy, is through military supremacy and bolstering the military capabilities of the actors that it cooperates with in the region. It also expanded what's called its Mediterranean dialogue to facilitate political dialogue with Middle Eastern countries such as Egypt and Jordan as well. And it's also played a very vital role in a lot of the normalization ties that came out of the Abraham Accords. And NATO's kind of been on the ground ensuring that the normalization, such as from Jordan, Bahrain, Morocco as well, is incentivized. So if you sort of toe the line, follow what the US and by the extension, the Western nations in Europe and NATO tell you to do, all of a sudden you have brand new fighter jets and brand new anti-air defense missiles and brand new tanks and whatever. I don't have exact stats for you for what weapons NATO has facilitated in the region, but you get the general idea. And so that's to present you a very clear, direct example of how we've seen sort of NATO's work in the Middle East show up recently in relation to Palestine. For one, early on in the Israeli genocide of Gaza and the Israeli offensive on Gaza and the West Bank and now southern Lebanon as well, the U.S. deployed a lot of its super high-tech air carriers and a lot of its ships from its navy. But it wasn't the U.S. alone. Other Western nations have also been found to have sent some of their ships, as well as doing, you know, the Air Force will always just like kind of take over the airspace nearby that they can, just to always provide this sort of intimidation to the regional actors that they oppose. It was very clearly seen when, first I'll talk about sort of the Houthi blockade. So the Houthis or Ansar Allah in Yemen have essentially created a blockade in the Red Sea. So any ship that has any sort of ties to Israel or plans to dock in Israel or is shipping from or to Israel, they've essentially targeted in a variety of ways. Shout out Yemen. And so for me, I like to view it as an optimistic example of the limitations of NATO and the fact that Palestine and the whole Palestinian cause and movement and resistance against occupation has kind of shown us that NATO and the Western powers, the axis of domination, is actually penetrable. You are able to inflict damage to it, you are able to resist it, and I think that's telling of a longer road to try and bring an end to this axis of domination. Because when the Houthis first started their initiative in the Red Sea, their blockade, the U.S. scrambled to find a coalition of nations to support its counter efforts against the Houthis in the Red Sea. And a lot of nations refused, including Gulf nations, refused to provide ships, refused to provide resources. And it was so dire that I think it was like Seychelles that was part of that coalition. I think Seychelles was just glad to be part of any sort of, it's like, we're a world player now, I guess. Seychelles is providing a ship to go to the Red Sea to support the US coalition against the Houthis. And I think it was very telling. I mean, Bahrain, Saudi, the UAE, none of them, they were like, we're gonna keep our hands off of this. And the reason I highlight those Gulf Arab nations specifically is because those have been the primary allies of NATO in the region. And there's been talk before about this idea of a Middle East NATO, which a lot of Western outlets insist it's not actually happening. You know, Israel really wants it, but the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, we don't want to impose our sort of Western imperial influence on them. But the reality is we saw that, you know, Middle East NATO is not a very formalized thing yet, but we did actually see it effectively in action when Iran sent that barrage of missiles and drones to strike Israel in response to Israel striking its embassy in Syria. We saw that Israel was not actually able on its own to completely defend against that attack. They had to recruit the help of Jordan. They had to recruit the help of intelligence from the US, from other European nations, from Saudi as well. And that example for me shows us the full picture of what NATO does, even if it's not been fully formalized yet into a organization that's called the Middle Eastern NATO or whatever they want to call it. It's already here. It already exists. The fact that Jordan was shooting down drones or missiles headed towards the state that is currently murdering Palestinians en masse is telling of how horrible NATO is as an organizing body, because all it does is essentially allow, especially in Palestine, it's been a key player in defending the genocide, facilitating the continuation of the genocide, and also imposing sanctions, for example, against Iran and other actors in the region. And it's using all its power to put down any sort of resistance against the genocide, which is by international humanitarian law allowed. I mean, it's not just allowed, it should be encouraged, if anything. And yet we see NATO, which frames itself as like the military arm of the UN, is actually facilitating the continuation of this genocide and disallowing any efforts to end it. So there was a quote I saw from German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, who said that Iran must be isolated when they conducted their attack on Israel because, quote unquote, because of course there must be a reaction to this unprecedented incident. Unprecedented incident. But there must be no further escalation in the region. Unprecedented incident. They sent like a few hundred missiles that mainly hit like military targets and the desert. That's unprecedented. Meanwhile, Israel bombarding Palestinian civilians in Gaza, detaining people unlawfully in the West Bank, destroying the local agriculture and local land and the sources of life in the land in the south of Lebanon, in Palestine, that's not unprecedented. That is not an escalation. But in fact, this one act that did not cause that much material damage to the Israeli state is called an unprecedented incident. I get really frustrated when I talk about NATO because it's, again, it has really good PR and people are like, yeah, but it's kind of just like a cooperation of nations, peacekeeping, la-di-da. They're partially responsible for the genocide of Gaza, of Palestinians. NATO is responsible in part for the genocide in Palestine. Let's be very clear about that. Let's be very clear about that. And the most insidious way that it is responsible is by essentially coaxing all these Gulf Arab states, Jordan, Morocco. You know, in the Arab world, we always mock our leaders because most of them are cowards. And a big part of the reason for that is that NATO has just exerted its influence in such a egregious, hegemonic way on the region that the calculation has become for a lot of Arab leaders is, okay, we can either like stand up for what we truly believe in, for our culture, our heritage, our dignity, our people in Palestine, and for the Ummah. The Ummah, if you're not aware, you know, in it's like a concept in Islam of like Muslims are kin to one another no matter what. Anytime you come across another Muslim, like they are your kin. You are supposed to be one unified nation, essentially, against any sort of aggression imposed on any of our people. And so there's this hypocrisy now where you have these Muslim states, almost like states where the politics are very much tied in with the theology, that have completely, completely abandoned those ideals, abandoned Palestine, and instead have said our way forward, our way to ensure our safety is to essentially stand down, take what NATO gives us, and cooperate with NATO and the Western nations and the US. And if Palestine goes, then it goes. That's essentially a big part of what NATO has done. It's subjugated these nations to its will, to the will of the Western imperialist nations. And now, unfortunately, Palestine is the one that has to suffer. Because the reality is, all these nations with their capabilities could bring an end to the genocide. They could, but they choose not to. They choose not to because they would rather maximize their profits, bolster their defense, and watch Palestine be genocided. It's pretty dire, but I will sort of, to end, kind of bring it back to a more hopeful message, which Gaza, as the tip of the spear of imperialism, as kind of the main, you know, NATO's doing a lot of stuff all over the place, but especially in Gaza, like we've seen just how horrific, or rather Gaza has shown us how horrific this imperialism is, this just egregious militarism and conducting efforts through military power, and just, it's shown us how awful that is. But it's also shown us that it's penetrable. It can be destroyed. It can be resisted. And it will be, because Gaza has resisted. Despite everything, Gaza has resisted. And Gaza still lives. Still lives. And more so than that, too, Israel is losing. They are. Israel is losing. The war has been an absolute disaster to their economy. You even see like European nations starting to back off bit by bit, saying, okay, no, we actually do want to see Palestinian statehood. Israel should calm the heck down and stop committing these war crimes. And I think that's very telling. That's a big part of that is the work we've done too, as people on the ground, pressing the issue every day, day after day, month after month, despite burnout, despite the anguish. Israel is losing its allies. It's losing the war on a military basis, which it makes up for by murdering another dozen civilians every day. And NATO is a big part of what allows Israel to continue its genocide, but it's losing, and NATO's also starting to become more and more exposed. And inshallah, like, we'll see a free Palestine and we'll see an end to this axis of domination by NATO. Thank you.
Lastly, we'll hear from Francis Dai-Hoon Lee of the Peace Education Project.
I'm going to speak about an urge for conflict prevention and common security vision in Northeast Asia in relation to preventing NATO expansion. I've been seeing huge changes in military security landscape in East Asia continuously since the time of Obama, but most significantly since 2022, with the war in Ukraine, but more changes in East Asia at the same time, especially South Korea and Japan. There's a huge change. Recently, all countries in Northeast Asia are undergoing one of the highest levels of military buildup and highest level of joint military exercises. Diplomacy and dialogues are gone. Hostilities are growing fast. There is obviously mutual escalation running into a clash in my mind. The crucial beginning in East Asia from the US is actually from Obama's time, pivot to Asia rebalancing. In terms of securitization, militarization, things have been changing and then speeded up with the so-called Indo-Pacific strategy by Trump administration. Indo-Pacific, it was the first time to hear this very strange formulation, Indo-Pacific, for the first time. Now, China, Russia, and North Korea didn't sit still. They reacted against such US actions fast and very strongly. The situation is now very worrisome. I plead to you that this is very, very worrying situation in East Asia. Let's look at South Korea first. Since 2022, we have a new government, very hawkish, and they've been cooperating with the US-led anti-China, anti-Russia military alliances very actively. This new Yoon government declared the full intention to confront North Korea with military force and aim for regime collapse, which is highly provocative to the government in DPRK. South Korea now repeats stronger alliance and cooperation scenarios with the US, with Japan, and with NATO. Peace through strength is now president's most favorite saying. South Korea's new deterrence initiatives are something that we need to watch carefully. South Korea and Japan, when they join US deterrence and militarizing actions, they are rich and they have huge military facilities and manpower. Since 2022, the change in South Korea was evident during the unusually prolonged and repeated joint military exercises between the US and South Korea, as well as US, Japan, and South Korea. And these military exercises, I would like to call war exercises, they are going almost every day throughout the whole year. And NATO countries from Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asian countries, Indonesia, Philippines, they join in these joint military exercises. And now it is East Asia, which is full of everyday military, multilateral military exercises. For example, 3 years ago, we saw 256 joint military exercises in and near South Korea alone. And some of those exercises included, quote and unquote, decapitation operation training, which is a de facto preemptive strategy to remove enemy's leadership and key assets. To some, this is almost a war breakout situation. And Japan, there is worrisome changes since 2022, too. That Japan announced a plan to increase its defense spending by 2% of GDP from 2023 for the next 5 years. It is aiming to double its defense budget by year 2027. And this will make Japan world number three military spender. And they are now in deep military alliance with the US, and also they are invited to NATO summit this week. And then Japan revised key security policies, specifying for the first time after the Second World War that it should have counterattack capabilities, and it clearly identified China and DPRK as major threats. And immediately after that, they began negotiations to purchase from 400 to 600 Tomahawk missiles from Japan. And these missiles are capable of hitting mainland China and Beijing included. And in response, North Korea launched more missiles and rockets than ever before. And crucially, in September 2022, I think we should remember this change in North Korea. They formalized the use of nuclear weapons into the law, stating that it would immediately launch nuclear strike if its leadership or military command were under threat. And now, just a few kilometers across the border from the DPRK, there is a joint military exercises going on almost every day. In Camp David, the three governments call it as a military or security cooperation, but they emerged with a de facto military alliance of three countries, and this is for the first time that is happening among South Korea and Japan and the U.S. I hope you imagine their military budget and their military capabilities and all the exercises they have gone through in terms of war readiness. As a consequence, nuclear armament talks began to surface in South Korea. In January 2023, President Yoon raised regional tension by saying, if North Korean nuclear issue worsens, South Korea may deploy tactical nuclear weapons or even possesses its own nuclear weapons. Now, this may is now changing will and should in the South Korean conservative politics. South Korea is now fully in for the U.S.-led extended deterrence with what they call the Korean three-axis system. This is almost a massive first strike and preemptive strike. And South Korea has some 500,000 strong standing army and more than 1 million reserve army. In response, North Korea held a summit with Russia twice since last year and signed a pact about 3 weeks ago that includes mutual defense, or to be more exact, collective security arrangement. This is for the first time since the Cold War time. We will see North Korea more visible and Russia more active in East Asia because of this pact. So what can we see from these changes? A grid of offensive alliances being realized here in Northeast Asia. The fastest. The fact is that the bilateral alliances maintained by the United States in each regions of the world is not only deepening and developing, but more closely connecting to the entire globe and space. The US-led East Asian alliance system is being reorganized at a rapid pace and orchestrated to a dangerous level. We need rethinking. We need new actions on the US alliance orchestration. Second, new relationships are forming among US alliance partners, such as Philippines, Japan, Australia, Japan, ROK, South Korea. Various small-scale cooperation between the so-called like-minded countries, such as Australia, Korea, and Japan, are constantly emphasized. We must say that the alliance system limited to East Asia is now closely connected to the security structure of Europe and the entire world. With South Korea providing weapons to Ukraine and North Korea beginning to provide arms to Russia, the Ukraine war, the Ukraine war marked the beginning of unifying security horizons of both sides of Eurasia. They are not separated. NATO has invited four Asian countries, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand to the summit since 3 years ago. And at the same time, they issued a strategic concept document stating China is a systemic threat and China is located in Asia. NATO confronts China, and this is a fact. This means NATO will come or has already come to Asia. And there is an agenda in NATO meeting to set up, establish NATO office in Tokyo. So I note that the way that the U.S. is strengthening security relationship with its partner countries resembles her behavior just after the Second World War. Please remember that Truman government pursued a U.S.-led global governance, governing global domination by establishing a multilateral alliance in Europe, NATO, and a spoke-style bilateral alliance network in Asia. And that is now happening again. What if this situation is not stopped? As weapons and troops are flooding in, hostilities are rising fast, incompetent leaders are taking over, nations are divided into blocs, the military alliances are flourishing. What will happen? I think we should anticipate the worst. Along that, we should anticipate big failure. If we cannot prevent the enormous waste of arms that created by arms race at the time of climate crisis, I think it is more than a regional crisis. I think it is more than a local armed conflict or war. It is very seriously more than that. So I'm really concerned. The hegemonic politics of securitization and bad leadership will explode into flames not very far from now. We must really worry about a bigger catastrophe that will follow if we fail to stop this confrontation in the Asia Pacific. Likewise, we need to shift our focus of envisioning peace and peace building to new agenda. I'd like to advocate that we should formulate new agenda so that we can act on new fronts. In Asia, Northeast Asia in particular, there are now urgent needs for early warning from every sector against possible armed conflict. And new diplomacy is necessary for changes in the regional security structure in order to establish a regional common security system. I think this is time that we should work step by step to establish common security regime. And my final plea is that common security starts by listening to and paying respect to security needs of all the parties involved in the region, face to face. That's the first thing. So therefore, what stands in front of us is not only denial of common security approach and respect of all sovereign states, it's a confrontational and aggressive, active, planned move of almost all Northeast Asian countries, and especially on this side, orchestrated by the U.S. Name, the NATO as the name is, does not exist yet in Northeast Asia, but the essence and the real militarized activities for NATO exist in Northeast Asia. Thank you.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was excerpts from a panel held at the No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference in Washington, D.C. on July 6, 2024. The conference was a counter-summit to NATO's 75th anniversary summit held the following week. Remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.